A very warm welcome to the This Is Money and Share Radio Christmas podcast. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce, and development editor Rich Browning from the award-winning This Is Money to talk through some of the stories on their website that they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, is the end of cheap and easy money over? A very big deal is made of a very little increase in a country far, far away.
The economic recovery has clearly come a long way, although it is not yet complete.
The Fed raises interest rates for the first time in nearly a decade. Where the US leads, are we to follow suit?
It's a signal to the British public. And my expectation would be actually next year we'll start to see interest rate rises here in the UK.
We'll explain what that move means for the pound in our pocket. Also, the Fed may have been hogging the economic limelight this week, but we've had some pretty significant data out too. Inflation ekes up a teeny tiny bit, employment falls, and globally, oil prices continue to slide. We'll be discussing all these, plus why are pensioner bonds back in the news? Lee, your moment has come again. Is a second-hand annuity market a good idea, or yet more confusion for pensioners?
You need to take advice because it's so complicated. I've been to a financial advisor. I had no idea. I do know a lot about finance, but I didn't know all the details.
And
it's the most wonderful time of the year.
I don't know about the most wonderful, but it's certainly that time of the year, the annual This Is Money and Share Radio Christmas Taste Test. And this year, we've gone all posh. Prosciutto, Stilton and Bubbles. And Brussels as well. Sorry, Simon. It's all to try to work out whether, with the rise of the discounters, you could sacrifice quality for price. Other supermarkets, discounters and opinions are available. It's all just a bit of fun. But we have been asking today for your Christmas food, heaven and hell. A very good morning, Simon, Lee, Rich. I'm going to start with you, Simon. Please, your Christmas food, heaven and hell. Is it on the list?
Hello, Georgie.
Happy Christmas, Simon.
My Christmas food, heaven. I would say pigs in blankets, but I think that's too much of a classic choice. I really like stuffing. I love stuffing.
I would have given you Christmas pigs in blanket.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, Christmas is a great time to basically stuff yourself with stuffing. Mm-hmm. And my Christmas food, hell, the one thing I can't stand is Brussels sprouts. They are horrible.
Here, here.
Bad luck, Simon. Bad luck. Because they are my Christmas heaven. Lee, a very happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas. Definitely my food heaven, pigs in blankets. I'm sorry, that is a basic choice, but absolutely brilliant. And I hate mince pies.
Bad luck to you again. Rich?
Morning, food heaven. Well, I'm pig blankets, obviously.
Clean sweep.
It's getting really boring already, sorry. And hell, bread pudding.
Bread pudding?
What is that all about?
Is that Christmas?
I don't know.
I thought that was an every time of year, wasn't it?
Oh, is that? Or maybe it's my strange household.
What's serving you up a pudding you don't like for Christmas? Happy Christmas, Dad.
Christmas exactly. Pudding's not much better, is it?
For me, my Christmas food heaven is Brussels sprouts. Ooh. And my Christmas food hell is turkey.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio. We're here on digital in London, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio for our weekly catch-up with me, running through some of the stories that they've been looking into over the last 7 days. And yes, I'm joined by editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce and development editor Rich Browning. A very warm welcome to this Christmas special. A veritable festive feast, quite literally, of all the personal finance news you need to know from the week, plus a sprinkling of our best bits from the year and an annual taste test. Other supermarkets and opinions are, of course, available. Let's start, though, with the big news of the week. It's got everyone talking for weeks, months, nay, years. In a galaxy far, far away, Well, New York, the Fed raised interest rates for the first time in nearly a decade. As expected, they went up 0.25%, so borrowing got that little bit more expensive.
The economic recovery has clearly come a long way, although it is not yet complete. Room for further improvement in the labor market remains, and inflation continues to run below our longer-run objective.
So that was Chair of the Fed, Janet Yellen there. So is this it? Crack open the Carver, the end of the financial crisis era, the end of cheap and easy money? So are we also in line next for a rise? Rates over here have been held at 0.5% for more than 6 years. Andrew Sentence is a former rate setter at the Bank of England.
It's a signal to the British public that interest rates are going to start to rise. And my expectation would be actually next year we'll start to see interest rate rises here in the UK.
And before we get the views of Simon and the team, personal finance expert Rachel Springall from moneyfacts.co.uk says Bank of England Governor Mark Carney has tough choices ahead.
He obviously has quite a big decision to make. And the fact is, all the stats are saying that the UK are doing quite well. I think his main fear is making a decision too quickly. So, you know, they are looking at all these statistics and they are looking at the overall growth of the economy and obviously unemployment and things like that. But it's just a case of not knowing exactly when it's going to happen. But I think it might well happen next year. We just have to wait and see on this front. But this is a big move, because obviously with America rising their interest rates, their currency is going to do well. You know, their stocks are going up and, you know, the UK are doing okay at the moment. And, you know, you may think that, well, we're next in line. If Europe's struggling but we're doing good, then why aren't we the next on the list to up rates?
Well, some call it risky, a gamble, others a necessity. But why has it got everyone so excited? Why does it indeed matter here? We also had inflation, unemployment figures out over here over the week, and combine that with oil prices as well. Loads to talk about. Simon, I'm going to come to you first to find out what this all means. But let's focus on the Fed's decision. Why have they done this, first of all?
They've done this primarily because this was the last opportunity to do this in 2015, I suspect. I don't think that they actually would have moved the rate if we'd have been, if you could take now and move it to earlier in the year, I think they would have thought they possibly got a little bit more time to do it. But there was a lot
more
of pressure.
Symbolic, is that what you're
well,
saying?
Well, maybe. I think this is a little bit symbolic, to be perfectly honest. However, what the Fed targets is it targets full employment and it targets inflation at 2%. Now, the US inflation rate that they use is considerably below 2%, but core inflation over there is at 2%, and that's the thing that takes out some of the things that has a tendency to skew inflation. So they're looking at it and they're saying the economy is on the mend, the recovery is entrenched. We don't think that there is a risk to raising rates by, let's face it, a tiny amount to a very, very low level, and we want to try and get on with things. And I think they're looking, you know, down the line and they're seeing that potentially there could be inflation coming, and what they're doing theoretically is moving to counteract that. But if you look at the flip side of it, basically, I think there was a lot of pressure on the Fed to raise rates this year, to put down a marker and say, yes, in 2015, we raised rates. And this was the last chance to do it.
This does have global implications. A lot of people talking about concern over particularly emerging economies.
Well, the issue is the way that monetary policy works is obviously people use interest rates to try and control inflation and to improve the economy. But it also has a knock-on effect on currencies, and the currency markets are very important. And so if a country looks that it's going, if it's going to see interest rates rising, it's in the upward cycle, then people will put money into that country because they think they're going to get a better return on that money. Because at the simplest level, if you put your money there and rates are on the way up, you should get a return, an interest rate return from that money there. Now, what this does is if you've got other countries that are looking as if rates are going to be cut, then you get a movement between the two. So the dollar has risen substantially against many currencies around the world over the past year. And for emerging market economies, many of them have borrowed in dollars. You know, there's government debt and there's corporate debt that is held in dollars, and that means they have to pay it back in dollars. And if their currency sinks against the dollar, then it costs them more money to pay back their debt.
First and foremost, I should have asked. So US rates have been at rock bottom, Simon, for a decade. In the UK, they've been at a historic low of 0.5% since March 2009. Why have they been so low for so long? If you take a look at your article, you talk about the rise and fall of US rates. Just take a look at Ronald Reagan's era, 20%.
Yes, but we had very high inflation in that era, and so they were essentially tackling inflation. Now, what you saw in the run-up to the financial crisis in the 2000s is this thing called the Great Moderation, where inflation pretty much disappeared. And at the same time, rates managed to come down. So you had low interest rates and low inflation, and everyone thought that, you know, things were just rosy and everything could continue on very, very well. But you also had a phenomenal amount of essentially money being created by stuff that was going on in the financial markets. So you had derivatives being used to slice and dice mortgages and also bet on mortgages and bet on bets of mortgages. And the things that you, what you needed in order to keep that party going was more and more mortgages being dished out. So there was this rush to just lend money to people at lower and lower standards. And when a bank creates money to lend to people, it basically just effectively kind of magics it out of thin air. You know, they enter some numbers on a computer and there's £200,000 in your bank account. And so you just saw this explosion in credit. And then we saw an almighty crash off the back of it. And what happens when you have an almighty crash like that is banks and businesses who've got all this debt, they try to deleverage. So they try to get rid of all the debt that they've got. And that puts a major dampener on the economy. And it crushed the world economy. It was a once-in-a-lifetime event, basically. Mm. The last time we saw something of this magnitude, you have to look back to the 1920s, you know, in the Great Depression. And at that time, the world was much less connected. You know, think of the way the financial world is connected now. So the upshot of that is that we've been on life support for the last decade in terms of interest rates.
Lee, in terms of the US decision, I'm not in America. Why do I care?
Well, it's going to put pressure on Mark Carney to raise rates here, you know, because you think the US has had low rates for longer than we've had here. It just puts pressure on Mark Carney, basically, to start thinking about really putting rates up. But you look at the
why does it, rate, Lee?
Well, you know, it's what they do in America obviously influences what happens in the global, you know, across the world. It's a massive economy. Yeah. So you're looking at if the times are starting to get good for the US, theoretically, hopefully, in the UK, it should be sort of following suit. So, you know, I reckon at some point next year, they're going to have to start really thinking about putting rates up here.
And the impact of that?
Well, it would just mean that your mortgage would probably get more expensive. But at the same time, savings rates might start finally edging up and people can get a bit of a return.
How quickly is that likely to happen?
Well, it never goes hand in hand, but it will have a knock-on effect eventually. And it's the one thing that could happen to actually make savings rates start going up.
Absolutely. We should be clear as well, though, Janet Yellen, as much as Mark Carney, saying that when interest rates do keep going up, they will go very incrementally.
Yeah, it'll be slow. There's no way it's just going to be all of a sudden we landed with big, you know, big numbers. It's just going to be 0.25 percentage points each time, you suspect. They wouldn't think it would go up any quicker than that over the next few years. You've got to tread water lightly. You don't just go in there and just shove the rate up really high, really fast. Because you know, the thing is, people would suffer. So you have to do these things slowly and see how it has an impact. And hopefully that's what will happen.
We're talking about divergence at the moment in terms of interest rates. And this,
explain what you mean by that.
Divergence is what they're talking about is that rates are going up in the US and they're tightening. Whereas in Europe, for example, the ECB has cut rates to even deeper into negative territory to minus 0.3%. And is talking about extending its quantitative easing, and people expect it to expand it. So they're moving in opposite directions. And that means you're going to have the dollar appreciating further against the euro. But there's also a divergence in US interest rates themselves, because basically the Fed publishes how its members see rates going up. And then you've got the market, the money markets, and how the money market sees interest rates going up. There's a big gap between that. The Fed expects to raise rates a bit faster and a bit more often than the markets expect. And somewhere between those two, there's some tension. And it's not this first one. It's what happens over the next year. Do they raise another three times? Do they raise another four times? And if they go, you know, more than that four, it's really going to catch the markets out. And that's when you'll start to see some turbulence.
Just a quick one. How have people responded to this, markets and the like?
They've responded. They've been happy. Because basically, we've gone from a situation this year where an interest rate rise in the States was feared to one where it was hoped for. And I'm not quite sure why we've gone from that, but it's just the way the narrative changes. People expected the Fed to raise rates in September, and the Fed didn't raise rates in September because, you know, there was a big storm on the stock market in August and issues in China, and people thought that they'd sort of ducked out of it a bit. So, you know, now that it's come round, if they hadn't have done it, then it would have been a surprise and people would have reacted badly.
So the central bank's chair, Janet Yellen, saying the recovery in America, while not yet complete, has clearly come a long way. Is that it, Rich? Is it the end of an era, as it were, the financial crisis? Is it really over?
I don't know about anybody else, but it strikes me that we're kind of stuck in this new financial Cold War where the UK's cowering over the Atlantic, waiting for America to decide basically our fate. And is that a good thing? I would have been a lot happier had the UK decided to make their own decisions and perhaps raised the rates here earlier in the year. We're being told that America is going to raise their rates several times next year, and you know, that's the narrative, so that's probably what's going to happen. So we will follow suit.
But I don't even know what I'm having for breakfast, Rich. How can they know what they're going to do in the next year?
They can't.
Well, there we go. So we don't know that that's the case.
I think you had bread pudding for breakfast.
Did I? Your leftovers, was it? So there we go. The US Fed may have been hogging all the limelight this week, but there have been a fair amount of other significant economic data to take note of. Here, inflation, unemployment figures as well were released. Globally, the price of oil falls even further. But let's start with inflation, shall we? And the rate of increase in prices for goods and services broken out from that negative level just, though. The prices rose by 0.1% annually in November. That's according to figures from the Office for National Statistics. So transport costs, alcohol and tobacco prices were the main contributors to the rise in the rate. Here's Pete Comley, author of Inflation Matters.
As ever with inflation, it's the changes you see often say more about what was going on with inflation last year than they actually say about what's happened this year. In terms of CPI, the actual index is almost exactly the same now as it was a year ago. But why the number appears to have gone up is that last November there was quite a big decline, and even though prices went down slightly this November, they didn't go down as much. So as I said, it says a bit more about last year. And last year what was going on is that petrol was going down a bit more last year, and so was alcoholic drinks, apparently. They didn't go down quite as much as this time. So that's the main driving force behind it.
Lee, what do you make of inflation figures? Edge into positive territory, but way off that 2% target.
Yeah, well, the main drag on it, isn't it, is the oil price. It just keeps falling, and it's making petrol cheaper. So you look last weekend, you know, the major supermarkets were offering unleaded under a pound. I think a few still are offering it for under a pound because oil has just crashed. So it just keeps edging down. It's going to mean that petrol prices keep falling, and that's going to be a drag on inflation. The other thing actually helping keep it low was the weather. You think about clothing sales this time of year, usually you're looking at people spending quite a lot of money on, you know, big coats, you know, winter goods. Clothing data on this is that retailers are having to heavily discount clothes to get rid of them because it's been so mild. These sort of things are helping keep inflation down. Interesting that alcohol was on the rise, one of the main contributors. Everyone's out boozing, isn't it? It's party season. So yeah. There we go.
You did mention, I should go on with oil. You did mention oil there. Simon, give us some context. We spoke about this last week, but it's got even worse, the situation for oil. What is keeping it going down so low?
The fact that basically the OPEC countries, the OPEC oil-producing cartel is just continuing to pump out oil. The fact that it's a traded commodity, so markets tend to move things possibly slightly further than they need to be. But there's a glut of oil, apparently, and more oil than we need at the moment, which is strange, isn't it, when we were only talking about peak oil not that long ago. But actually, Pete made a really interesting point there, which is, and this is something that people really struggle to get their heads around with inflation, is the reason why the inflation rate ticked up slightly to this 0.1% is because even though petrol is falling and is cheaper than it was last year, it didn't fall as much in November as it did last year, which is very difficult maths to get your head round when you think that the CPI index is theoretically measuring the cost of a basket of goods. It's like, if the thing in that basket is actually cheaper, why is that not taking the number down? But there's an interesting thing that's going to come through in December, actually, because I looked at these figures earlier in the week when the inflation figures came out, And actually, petrol last year in December fell by quite a lot. The price of a litre of petrol, on average, fell by nearly 6p over the month. Now, the price of a litre of petrol has also fallen quite a lot this month, but it's a bit neck and neck. It still fell by a little bit more in December 2014. But who knows what's going to happen for the rest of the month? And that could have a really big impact on where December's inflation figure comes out, which is also quite important because that will then give us the inflation figure for the year. And at the moment, the ONS says that basically 2015 so far has been the year of no inflation. So despite that slight
flat,
tick up,
hasn't it? Apart from a little bit up, flat, a little bit down.
Being between like minus 0.1 and 0.1. I mean, this 0.1, you know, could be the start of hyperinflation, though.
Could be.
For, you know, mighty oaks, small acorns and all that.
You never know, but expectation suggests...
Probably not.
Probably not. When are we going to get to that 2% target?
I don't know. It'd be quite interesting, actually, to see whether we ever get to that 2% target before another recession comes around. But actually, it's worth bearing in mind that Britain is an inflation-prone country. So we might have very low inflation at the moment, and we have had, you know, for the last basically pretty much 2 years. But prior to that, inflation was persistently above that 2% target.
Why do you say inflation?
And the Bank of England was persistently getting its inflation forecast wrong. They were saying it was going to come down to the 2%, and it was consistently above it.
Yeah, why do you say inflation prone, though? Yeah.
We import a lot of things, so we are prone to currency movements. So if the pound sinks, stuff gets more expensive for us. And also, I think that, you know, because not only do we do that, but we import a lot of things like energy and stuff like that. And I just think that we are just prone to being above that 2% rather than below that 2% in this country. And it'd be interesting to see what happens when wage rises. People start making, you know, wage demands, whether that's going to come through. But there was a report out this week suggesting that if inflation stays low, we might see pay rises disappear again, unfortunately.
I was going to say, Rich, potentially good for that pound in our pocket. And Simon, you just ruined it.
It's a really complicated thing to get your head around, inflation, because what does it actually mean, you know? We've just seen the price of oil come down for the whole of the year, and yet we've had a year without inflation. It's great, though, isn't it? Stuff not costing as much in the shops.
Isn't it? But what's the worry, though? If it continues to stay flat, are we going to dip into negative territory? What does that mean? Deflation? Dangerous deflation?
Well, there's this theory that basically if you have deflation, people won't buy things because basically they'll put off purchasing until tomorrow what they could buy today because they think it will get cheaper tomorrow. But you really only get that if you get persistent proper deflation. I'm talking like a strong minus 2% for a period of time. But even then, I'm not so sure the British consumer has the mettle to put off that kind of purchase. The British consumer likes to buy things today, preferably yes, on finance. And also, we've had a great test of this, haven't we, over the years in terms of the way that our shops are now obsessed with discounting and sales. Mm. And basically, is there anything that you could think that you could buy that you suspect probably isn't going to be on sale at some point in the future? No. And yet, we do still go out and buy all those things.
A very fair point. Simon, you did, though, mention their wages. We heard this week unemployment fell to a 7-year low of 1.7 million official figures, showing the number of people out of work fell 110,000 in the 3 months to October. It means more than 31 million people now have a job, the highest since comparable records began in 1971. Employment Minister Priti Patel says the employment rate is now almost 74% and wages are continuing to grow.
This is also a reflection of strong economic growth, the fact that we built the foundations for a strong economy over the last 5 years. But also we've seen not just the record employment growth, we've seen more young people in work, more women in work.
Prime Minister David Cameron also celebrated the latest job figures, saying the economy is growing, Britain is getting stronger.
There are 500,000 more people in work in our country in the last year alone. We've had wages growing above inflation every month for a year, and the claimant count is at the lowest level since 1975.
So, Simon, good news all round.
It is good news all around, and I would say, you know, that they've managed to do that over the last 5 years, and I think we should applaud what the Lib Dems achieved. during that coalition period. Tories can't claim all the credit for that, can they? Look, it is good news. It shows that the economy is recovering. And the thing is, there's been a concern about the quality of those jobs, though. How many of them are people on zero-hour contracts? How many of them are people who've gone self-employed, not really because they've gone self-employed to improve their circumstances, but because they've maybe lost their job or they can't find another one, and they're doing low-level self-employment? But the fact that wages are going up is a really good thing, because wages have been stagnant for too long. The cost of living has been climbing over much of that period. And, you know, we need people to get back to a position where they're earning enough to live on. So it is good news.
Some people have suggested wage growth across the economy slowing to 2%, and that's sort of a bit of bad news. And also separate evidence as well came in a Bank of England latest report that would suggest soggy pay growth.
Yeah, nobody likes soggy pay growth, do they? Because it sounds like a disease, doesn't it?
I've got
terrible soggy pay growth. I went and saw a doctor about it the other day. He said, oh, I've got terrible soggy pay growth as well, that Jeremy Hunt. The worry is, like, joking aside, the worry is that basically companies will look at the fact that there's no inflation and go, well, actually, we won't give you that 3% because inflation's zero. So how about we cut your pay rise down to 1%? And then inflation bounces back and all of a sudden we've got pay growing by less than inflation. I think what we need is people to have that bit of leverage over their employers. And that's what really gets people's wages rising. And, you know, we do need to get rid of our bad case of soggy pay growth. Get on the antibiotics.
We do indeed. Editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money alongside Lee Boyce and Rich Browning.
So you want to learn to make the most of your money? Of course you do. But you want to learn while also listening to satirical songs and sketches? Of course you do. And that's why we invented Managing My Money. Let me move your rates up
and down. Huge debt. So won't the real big savers
please stand up? Please stand up. Managing My Money is an official Open University course. You can take the tests and earn yourself an Open University certificate to show how financially savvy you've become. So join Annie Weston and me, Glenn Goodman, on Share Radio 6 days a week. And if you miss an episode, you can go to shareradio.co.uk to find out when it's repeated, or just download a podcast instead. It's never been easier to fill that hole in your no-zone layer.
Indeed. Do go online, shareradio.co.uk, for more information. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me. Joined today, editor Simon Lambert alongside Lee Boyce and Rich Browning. Now, do you remember pensioner bonds? It seemed, Lee, at one stage earlier this year we were talking about them. Well, every week, well, they are back in the news now. Older savers may have got a bit of a shock this week after it was announced the interest rate on the government's one-year pensioner bond is to be slashed almost in half, from 2.8% to 1.45% within weeks. Here's Deborah Hargreaves, finance expert and founder of the HighPay Centre.
These pensioner bonds have been so popular. Mm. Everyone rushed into them because you can't get much income on your savings anywhere. And in fact, my dad bought one and he tried to get in there. The website crashed. I think there was so much demand. So he's one of these people who's going to be affected by this cut. And it does seem to be a bit rough on them. You know, once you've got the good interest rate, you'd hope that would last for a bit longer than just a year. But National Savings does this when its products are very popular. It cuts off demand by cutting rates. It's done it with a lot of its other products. And it must also mean that it's looking at the likelihood of a Bank of England interest rate rise as being less likely. Because, you know, no interest rates seem to be rising.
Now, Lee, this is yours now. Your moment has come again. I remember when we went live to the This Is Money headquarters for a phone interview with you about it. That was how big these were. I should say these 65-plus guaranteed growth bonds. Now, it's time to blow your trumpet, Lee. You did say to people at the time, did you not, to opt for the 3 year?
I thought the 3 year was a better deal. I mean, it's 4%. It was paying 4%. This was paying 2.8%. After a year when it was going to mature, you knew this was going to happen. You know, the hunch was that this rate was going to completely crumble, which is what's happened. You know, they offered these pensioner bonds just before the election. That's funny, isn't it? And £13 billion went into them. I mean, they were massively popular. George Osborne was saying, you know, it was the most successful financial product in history. And so people went into them in their droves. And then sneaky NS&I You know, they don't tell us, they don't send out a press release saying, oh, we're cutting the rates. You know, have to find out elsewhere, you know, get tipped off. And then, you know, we break the story that these rates are going to crumble. But it's just, you know, astonishing. But at the same time, people that took out a 1-year bond knew that it was going to be for 1 year and would probably have known that this rate was going to fall. So it's going to fall from 2.8% to 1.45%. But you can take the money out and go elsewhere that you're not committed to stay, you know, in that 1.45% rate. And there are 1-year fixed rates currently in our Best Buy tables that are paying more than 2%. In fact, there's loads that are paying more than 2%.
Well, an NS&I spokesman said, as with all our standard products, the interest rates on NS&I's guaranteed growth bonds are set to balance the interest of savers, taxpayers and the wider market whilst offering a 100% guarantee. Tell us more about what that statement means.
People feel safe in an NS&I product because it's government backed. You know, so it does have a bit of added security and people see it as a bit of a safe haven to hold their cash. But at the same time, I mean, a fixed rate savings account at a bank or building society is covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. So as long as you haven't got more than £75,000 in one of those savings accounts, then you're going to have that kind of same sort of, you know, security as you would with an NS&I product. So that's the thing. And it's going to be interesting because there's going to be a real glut of money when this matures next month, flooding into the savings market. So it could actually potentially drive competition down because people are starting to put more cash into fixed rate bonds. So providers aren't having to do as much to attract funds in.
Were you surprised by this move? I just reading through some comments by some independent experts saying disappointing, although not wholly unexpected.
Exactly. It wasn't wholly unexpected. Look, these bonds, when they came out at the start of the year, were market leading by some way. You know,
and they were quite controversial, we should say as well. Younger people saying it was a bit unfair.
Yeah, well, you know, let's face it. I mean, just before an election, over 65s is a Conservative prime target for votes. I mean, it's not beating around the bush about it. And it was, you know, very unfair. But then, you know, the government would turn around and say, well, look, we've launched a Help to Buy ISA or, you know, other things that do focus on other generations. But, you know, these were quite tasty bonds when they came out at the start of the year.
Well, from this week, 470 savers with money invested in that 1-year pensioner bond have 30 days to move to another account or face that cut, as we said. I do want to ask you, Andrew Hagger, finally, founder of MoneyComms, that's a saving website, says many savers may feel like they've been missold pensioner bonds. That seems quite strong.
I don't like the thought of the word missold in this circumstance. I mean, it was a 1-year bond. I think people know that it's fixed for 2.8% for a year and that there's going to be a rate at the end. It's just that the cut is pretty severe. You know, they could have done it a little bit more gradually or something that was at least competitive, you know, with other 1-year fixed rates that are currently on offer, and they haven't done that.
Well, we're going to stick with pensions. And another move announced today, the government announcing pensioners with an unwanted annuity will be able to sell it second-hand for cash. So it means 5 million pensioners who had been forced to turn their nest eggs into an income for life are soon to be allowed to exchange them from April 2017. But there are fears. Those who got a poor value annuity the first time round, well, they could get ripped off again, while others could be hit with tax bills as taking out a lump sum may push them into a higher tax bracket. And it's got us asking yet again, does this mean the death of annuities?
I think that annuities still have some value. What an annuity does give you that's very difficult to get through any other route is a guaranteed income for the rest of your life. And that can continue to your husband or wife if you die before they do. So I think that for many people, that guaranteed secure income is a really valuable benefit to have. And I think many people will continue to want to have some secure income, but they might want to use the balance of their pot to buy a more flexible product. I really hope that people don't have the impression that annuities are inherently bad, and therefore as soon as these new flexibilities become available, that they rush to get rid of them and turn them back into cash.
Well, that was Stephen Cameron from Aegon UK. Simon, tell us a little bit more about the changes.
Well, these changes are all the sort of one of the final pieces of the jigsaw of the pension freedom movement, which basically, in order to shake up the retirement income market, where most people who had a defined contribution pension, which is one where their employer hasn't promised to give them a pension for the rest of their life, they had to go out and use their pension pot to buy an annuity. You could keep it invested, but the rules were quite restrictive on that, and not that many people could benefit from it. Annuities were considered to be bad value and a market that wasn't particularly competitive. Some of that was not annuity companies' fault. It's to do with interest rates falling down to near zero. But people felt that they didn't really want these annuities. They're not very flexible. Once you've bought them, they will provide you with a secure income for life. They may provide your spouse with one after you've died, but the money's gone. You can't get it back. And people have preferred to... What the experience we've had since the pension freedom changes came in April is that people have preferred to use the more flexible option to keep their pension invested and try and get an income from that way. So the idea is people will be able to sell these annuities back in some form of marketplace, and then they can take the cash, put it in their investment account, take it out as cash, do what they want with it.
Sounds great, but
the problem is when you ask people what they would like from a retirement product, they say they'd like security of income for the rest of their lives and to know exactly how much they're going to get. And the product that provides security of income for the rest of your life with you knowing exactly how much you're going to get is something called an annuity, which everybody says they don't want. So they're in a bit of a bind.
You don't think annuities are based on the latest interest rate? And so if we are entering now a period of interest rates rising and people are going to start looking at annuities again, it's quite a good way of, if it's not fixed.
So Rich is right, actually, and this is a really, really good point. If you sold your annuity now, then as long as you didn't end up paying too much money, losing too much on selling the annuity, and then you put the money in the bank or put the money in an investment account, and if interest rates do rise and you bought an annuity in 5 years' time, you'll probably get a much better income from that annuity that you could buy in 5 years' time. But what you're then doing is speculating with your pension pot.
Ah, yes, indeed. Let's turn our attention, shall we, away from pensions and on to housing. And we will lose our dream home because Nationwide won't give us a mortgage unless we buy insurance from a provider that doesn't sell it anymore. We'll explain all what that means. But first, let's focus on some bad news if you are looking to get on the housing ladder anytime soon. Perhaps you've got yourself a Help to Buy ISA, but by the time you can get the most from the government boost, around 4 years, where on earth will house prices be? Well, according to a new report, it doesn't look too pretty. House prices set to leap by another 50%, it's being predicted, over the coming decade, with the average commanding a price of £419,000 by 2025. So tell us a little bit more about this. What's it based on?
It's predictions from the National Estate Agents Association. So they're just sort of forecasting, you know, looking at this whole supply and demand issue, which is, of course, something that's been bubbling over for the last couple of years now. The simple fact is more people want to buy a home, but there's not enough homes to buy, so it's just ramping up prices. And unless we're building more homes, which is something, again, we've been talking about the last couple of weeks, with George Osborne announcing 400,000 homes, the loosening of green belt planning restrictions. Unless more of that's sort of done and more houses are being built, then there's going to be severe upward pressure on house prices over the next 5 years. And we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago about the Help to Buy ISA when it came out, just how helpful that Help to Buy ISA will be in 5 years' time if you use it over that whole period of time, because by that time that happens, the deposit could theoretically double. But we're talking, how do we know what's going to happen in 5 years? It's impossible, isn't it?
So. Ask Janet Yellen. She's really good at working this sort of thing out.
So 50% sounds like a lot, doesn't it? But 50% over 10 years is only 4% a year. It's worth noting that, basically, the magic of compounding and everything like that. But the problem is we're starting from a position where houses are already expensive. They're already nearly as expensive as they've ever been against wages. So they've only ever been more expensive at the peak of the 2000s boom. So actually to see them rise by 4% a year for the next decade to deliver that 50% is quite a bad thing. Because even if wages went up by the same amount, that gap between the average salary and the average house will get bigger and bigger.
Oh, put the calculator away, Simon. Goodness me, it's all in his brain. That's the worst thing about it. Well, where they are looking, say you have found yourself a nice house, you've managed to locate one, that's amazing. However, it might be on a floodplain. You might have to get insurance, and you might be told you have to get insurance from a provider that doesn't sell it anymore. Lee, give us some more details.
Yeah, let's say there's a couple that we've written a story about earlier in the week that wanted to buy a house in Egham in Surrey, which unfortunately does come with a flood risk. So they've tried to get a mortgage through Nationwide. Nationwide are saying you've got to take out insurance policy with the company that already has the house insured, and you have to get a new policy with them. That's a part of the term of the mortgage. Phoenix don't offer this kind of insurance anymore. So they can't get the insurance through Phoenix. So they're basically, it's a bit of a computer says no type nationwide, being really sort of strict on this. And I guess what could be in the forefront of their minds is all the stuff that's happened in Cumbria, obviously, in the last couple of weeks. You know, flood damage is very, you know, it can be very expensive. You run into hundreds of thousands of pounds. So, you know, a lender has to be sensible and has to say, look, this is on a flood risk, you know, site. But I think the argument in this is that the couple are willing to accept that, and they've looked around for other insurance policies offering exactly the same as Phoenix, but Nationwide aren't having any of it. I don't think this property has actually flooded. I think it's got a flood risk, and it's raised 3 feet off the ground. So you start putting those things into consideration. You say, well, actually, the flood risk on this is slightly smaller than what first appears. But unfortunately, sometimes lenders are just, especially at the moment, you know, very tight on who they're borrowing onto and, you know, lending to. And they have to be. They have to do the due diligence. But this is a bit over the top.
Well, indeed, the whole of Egham is a flood risk area. The house raised 3 feet off the ground. It's never been flooded before, just its boundaries. I don't know about Egham, but Mole Valley in Surrey, I don't know if that's a flood risk area, but it's jumped 12 spots to reach 7th place in the place with the best quality of life in the UK. Where is the best place? It is Hart in northeast Hampshire. For the 5th year in a row now, research by Halifax looks at things like life expectancy, employment and crime rate. South Oxfordshire came second, up 19 places on last year. Martin Ellis from the Halifax thinks it's down to a mix of factors.
Those places have typically improved, for example, in terms of crime rates dropping. They're not polluting as much. They're actually doing better in terms of education scores as well. And also people are saying they're happier than they were sort of a year ago.
So there you go, Rich. What do you think makes a place have the best quality of life?
Well, anywhere with the word valley in its name is going to have a head start, I think. There's so many of these reports, aren't they, that come out about the best place to live, and they all kind of contradict each other. But I live in a place that has been voted the best place in the past, and I'm not going to tell you where it is. And if a place feels like it was the model for Trumpton, then it's definitely a place to live. You have your ambulance, your police, and your windmill all in the right place, then that is something to aspire to, I think.
I think it is indeed, and you probably pay for it as well. But it has come that time.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, with the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you.
Yes, it's what we've been waiting for. Well, maybe not Simon, but we'll be sure to give you extra Brussels, Simon. But bigger, better than last year, the annual This Is Money and Share Radio Christmas Taste Test has arrived. It's a bit of fun, and do remember, of course, other supermarkets' opinions, etc., etc., are most definitely available. But this year has been the rise of the discounters. Indeed, latest reports saw Aldi and Lidl hold on to their 10% market share. Sales increased 15.4%, 17.9% respectively, with 10 million shoppers flocking to the German discounters in the run-up to Christmas. Rivals Asda, Morrison's, Tesco, as it seems all year, equally in for a rather unhappy Christmas. Sainsbury's the only one to have seen growth this autumn. Here's Hannah Maundrell from money.co.uk.
Aldi and Lidl have just absolutely stormed the way this year and made life very, very difficult for the other big supermarkets, who are really having to up their game and focus their strategies to hold their place in the market, that they now clearly need to find their differentiating feature and market to customers to whom that appeals to. If they just continue to go for everything for everybody and go for the race to the bottom price war, it's not going to be a sustainable business model.
So that was Hannah Maundrell from money.co.uk. But can you get quality at good price? And indeed, is the price difference, well, that marked? Well, we thought we'd try it out. Last year it was a battle between Lidl and Waitrose. This time round, we've introduced struggling Tesco into the mix and added two new food items. Well, last year's winner on taste alone, edging it, was Waitrose. But when you added in price to the mix, well, the team thought that Lidl sailed away with the top prize. But who gets it this year? So as we go through the three courses, we'll be discussing the year for our supermarkets. But producer Kirsty has arrived in the studio to tell us what they're going to be trying first. Kirsty?
Well, you've got so many treats to come, but we're starting with the very, very best, The Brussels sprout.
Simon, one for you. Do you want to take the first offering? There we go.
Go on then, I'll get it over with.
Okay.
Okay, sprout me up.
Okay.
Right.
I don't know what you want there. What it fed to you?
A, B and C.
Right. A, B and C. Okay, this is sprout. Sprout letter A.
A.
Yep, tastes like a sprout. It's pretty horrid.
Okay, everybody dig in, and I want you to mark scores A, B and C, if that is all right for you. So while they are digging into... Oh, Simon, you are a picture right now. This is classic. Shame it is radio. But we want to know a little bit more about the year of the discounter, this has been called. I had quite a few stats there. Sales increasing by quite a substantial amount. There's lots of... If only I had a camera on me. Actually, I do. So, Simon, I'm going to hand over to you while you... I hope you're going to finish those, young man. Tell us the discounters. What a year it's been.
Well, firstly, I'm not going to finish them. You're not my real mum. secondly, I think the discounters, they've had another good year because, basically, they've promoted themselves not just on price. They've promoted themselves on quality. And I think people like the quality. And they get people in with things like decent bottles of wine and good offers on nice food, and people have gone there and decided, well, I quite like this. I quite like this absence of too much choice. I quite like the simplicity of it, and I very much like the prices. So I think it's really interesting what's happened there. It's just whether they can actually keep that up and sustain that over the next 2, 3, 4 years is the question.
Well, that's it as well, especially when we're seeing such expansion. We'll talk about that, but we will quickly go through the Brussels sprouts. Is it A, B or C for you, Simon?
C.
C for Simon.
It edged it.
Yep.
A for me.
A for Lee and for Rich.
Oh, definitely A.
A. Can you tell me why, perhaps, Rich, you picked the A?
It was perfectly formed and nutty.
Nutty?
It really was nutty.
Nuttiness that you expect from a Brussels sprout.
I like to think I'm a bit of a Brussels connoisseur.
I thought C was a bit citrusy.
Yeah, it had a weird... they were under-seasoned. That was the problem. And they needed a little bit of butter to really bring out the flavours.
All right.
But, you know.
I did them last night. Come on, lads. And what is next? What do we have next, producer Kirsty? All right then, Lee.
Sorry, Lee. We have got some delightful turkey. Now, we'll have to be clear here. We didn't roast these ourselves. These are turkey slices from the various supermarkets.
But it's better than last year.
Christmas, folks.
This is what I'd feed my dog. Look at it.
It's better than last year because we had a turkey ham mix, I think is what it was called. But Lee, Simon talked there about the sustainability of the discounters. We've seen Lidl, for example, investing £1.5 billion in the state-of-the-art stores, plans to roll out 40 new stores annually. Can they still maintain that low price while still expanding at this rate?
Well, they must be factoring in all this. They must know that at the end of the day, this is their unique selling point. They're offering things, they're undercutting their rivals. And if they start putting prices up, then people are going to stop going there. And then also, you look at things like the living wage, you know, both are jacking up their wages, also offer really good apprenticeships and stuff like that. So they are, it's not like they're really skimping on stuff, but it will be interesting to see if they maintain it. And actually, looking at sort of Asda, which has really struggled in the last sort of 6 months or so, and Tesco, that's losing a bit of its market share, it's very interesting. The one thing that they can beat Aldi a little on is petrol. So, you know, they don't have petrol forecourts, whereas Asda and Tesco do. Get them in with underpound petrol and try and get them into the stores. And that's the only thing they've had this festive season to try and combat.
It comes full circle. Turkey, please, Simon.
B.
Turkey B?
Yeah, I thought it was it's a bit thicker than the other turkey. It tastes a bit more sort of succulent.
OK, thank you very much. Lee?
B.
B. Rich?
Well, this is proof that having a real turkey for Christmas dinner is better than having...
All right. You cook three massive turkeys.
I'd definitely B.
B, B. Okie dokie. What's coming up next, please? Producer Kirsty.
It's prosciutto. That's got us a little bit nervous about the pronunciation, but there it is, looking delightful.
And also, I believe we've got some Stilton as well there.
We do indeed, yep. So...
We are
Tuck
treating
on
you,
in.
Lads.
It is the full shebang. Got some crackers to go with it. Those aren't being taste tested, by the way.
OK, so I did have a few rules when I did this. We rounded up numbers and it was the store's own brand. So where are we in terms of prosciutto, Simon?
I will go prosciutto C.
C.
Please. Per favore.
Lee?
I'm going to say A.
On balance, I'm going to go with C. I'd like to have had more to taste.
Go get some more.
Okie dokie. Stilton, please.
C.
see for Simon.
Hold on.
In which state, I will then ask, Simon, 2016, what it looks like for our supermarkets. What are they going to do to combat the discounters?
Well, I think that what you've seen is they've pulled out all the stops in various different ways to try and combat the discounters. And I'm not sure how many of these ideas have worked. So, for example, you had things like Tesco doing its thing where at the till they give you a voucher to say that your shopping was X amount more expensive than it was in competitors, so here's 50p off your next shop and things like that. I think it's just confusing. I think the supermarkets need to move away from this solely competing on price or confusing people with 3-for-2 deals and things like that. And I think they've wised up to that fact and they are starting to do that. And I think that's where they can steer themselves away from the discounters and take them on. I think what's really interesting is the fact that Sainsbury's has been the one that's continued to do better than the other big supermarkets. And I think that that is because people think that the food is nicer at Sainsbury's. And
I'm
also,
sorry I didn't test
you know,
Sainsbury's.
I'm delighted to have seen the return of Mogg, which I'm a big fan of Mogg.
Exactly. Are we talking about Christmas TV ads
yes,
and the like?
Yes, Christmas advert, Mogg the cat in the Sainsbury's advert.
That's my final question. Who won the battle of the Christmas TV adverts? But don't answer just yet. Stilton, please, Lee.
See, it had a really delicious smoky flavour, that. Really nice.
OK. Mm. Rich, Stilton?
A, please. It was nice and sloppy.
Okie dokie. What came next? We've got, I believe, mince pies and some carver. I'm sorry, I couldn't afford the champagne. Saving that pound in your pocket. So as Simon tucks in to his mince pie there, Simon, what do you make of that mince pie?
I think it's quite nice, but I've got a bit of an issue with mince pies.
OK.
And I always feel that they're let down by not actually having any meat in them.
Totally agree.
OK, that is a fundamental problem. So in terms of that, who won the Christmas TV adverts?
Mogg.
Mogg. So
Sainsbury's Mogg.
Lee is not a big fan of that,
oh,
Lee.
No, I hate mince pies so much.
Okay, that's great.
Why is there no mince in it?
Should say on the Christmas advert front, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, our personal finance editor, wrote a wonderful column yesterday where she looked at the ways some of these companies are promoting themselves, and she honed in on a John Lewis advert. And not the John Lewis advert that you're thinking about with the man on the moon, but it was one she found in the paper the other day that she held up to me and said, look at this. And basically, it is the king of no-frills, unsubtle advertising. It's basically a picture of a laptop, and it just says, show someone they're loved this Christmas next to it. It's just like, that's brilliant, isn't it? Show someone they're loved, buy them this laptop.
Buy a laptop. OK, so mince pies, how are we doing, please?
I'm going to go C on the mince pies.
C?
Begrudgingly, I'm going to go for A, best of a bad bunch.
OK.
C, please.
C. And finally, we've got some bubbles.
Ooh,
there.
That's better.
What's the aroma you're getting there, Lee? Is it a fruity?
I'd say there's a hint of elderflower in this one.
A hint of elderflower. Simon?
C.
Simon's on the already bubbles. Gone for
yeah.
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Simon?
C on the bubbles. I leapt in there.
Oh, is that Lambrisco? That really reminds me of Christmas.
Rich?
Yeah, C. It was the least sweet, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to go with C for that.
You're going to go with C. Well, we will give you the scores after the news.
Share Radio.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids jingle belling and everyone telling you be of good cheer.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website. Still with me in the studio for our weekly catch-up, joined today by editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce, and development editor Rich Browning. And it's what you've been waiting for. The results are in. We've been having our bigger and better than last year annual This Is Money and Share Radio Christmas taste test. The results are in. The team have been tasting delightful sprouts, carver, Stilton, turkey, prosciutto, and mince pies from Lidl, from Tesco, and from Waitrose. Before we get down to the maths, and I tell you, it is slightly addictive, actually, really, here. I can even tell you how much they've gone up and down. But Kirsty here, the producer, is here to tell us what the team have decided. We'll start with sprouts. Isn't that what we started with?
Yes, that is what you started with. And I have to say, the winner was Tesco.
Tesco, I have to say, yeah, you're absolutely right, lads.
Solid sprouts there. Yeah, they knew what they were doing in that year's harvest. Yeah, lovely. Yeah, they've really given that some love and attention.
Did Georgie, you're a sprout fan,
yeah, massive,
right?
Yeah.
Did you think they were noticeably bigger? Because there was loads of stories out, wasn't there, a couple of weeks back saying sprouts were going to be bigger this year because they'd had ideal sprout growing conditions in autumn.
Do you know what? I noticed actually Tesco was smaller, and I wonder if that affected the taste and made them slightly sweeter. Yeah. That wasn't on purpose. I can tell you, I've also worked out, obviously you get them different sizes. It's per 100 gram or each, if you've got a mince pie. So sprouts from Lidl, you get 750 grams for 39 pence, which works out at 5p per 100 grams. Incidentally, last year it was 7 pence, so they were actually down 2p. Ooh. Tesco, 500 grams, 39p, which works out at 8 pence per 100 gram. And actually, I thought the worst in terms of taste test was Waitrose sprouts, 330 grams for £2.05, which works out at 62 pence.
Get out of town.
Per 100. Last year it was 63 pence, so they've at least dropped their figure by 1 pence.
There you go. It's not only David Cameron having a Brussels showdown.
Where can I go with that one? What was next?
Well, this was the turkey, the very nice cold sliced turkey, and it was an absolutely resounding one for the discounter Lidl. All three picked it. It was number B.
Can I also say there was no turkey ham concoction? This was all 100% turkey.
Well, and question the 100%-ness of what we're looking at here.
All right, then. OK, on the packaging, it said turkey. No ham, apparently. So for 100 grams, Lidl, £1.21. For Tesco, £1.49. And for Waitrose, £2.95. Next up.
Next up, we had the prosciutto and another win for Lidl, but this time with two votes. Simon and Rich voting for Lidl, Lee bigging up Tesco.
No votes for Waitrose, eh? It should be the place to go for posh ham.
Blimey. So from Lidl, £1.39 for 100 grams. From Tesco, £2.02. And from Waitrose, £2.99. And then we had...
We had some cheese, Georgie. We had the Stilton. And a win for Tesco. Rich going for Waitrose, none for Lidl this time.
So the Stilton, you can get £1.45 for, 60 cents, 66p for 100 grams. From Lidl, you can get £1.20 from Tesco, and you can get £1.32 from Waitrose. Not a huge change in price. I should say one of the rules was it has to be shop own brand, and also we've rounded up to the nearest penny. And next we have the mince pies. It's a serious business here, Simon. Mince pies.
Tesco takes the lead.
Goodness me.
Tesco doing pretty well.
Wow. Okay. Tesco is bouncing back, isn't it? It is bouncing back.
Shopping there again.
So for mince pies, you can get per mince pie, Lidl, they come in 12 packs, by the way, 12 pence per mince pie. Last year they were 13p. Tesco, 15 pence. Waitrose, 42 pence.
Ooh.
Last year, they were 67 pence.
So we've had mince pie deflation.
We have at Waitrose by quite a significant amount. And finally, please, the carver.
Yep, it was all three voting for Lidl. It's pretty neck and neck between Tesco and Lidl.
Carver, then, £4.79 from Lidl. £5 from Tesco, very close. £7.31 from Waitrose. I can tell you the full shop for each of them, which was the biggest surprise, I think, of all. Lidl, £8.22. Tesco, £9.94. Waitrose, £15.61. So almost double the price of Lidl. Difference between £1.72 from Lidl and Tesco. Tesco came out better in, equal number of taste tests. So where would we lie that then?
Well, I think there needs to be a sudden death because it's 3-all, isn't it?
Tesco, I think it's sprout
three,
off.
Lidl 3. Oh, no. I think you need to go and get us a bread pudding from somewhere. That could be the sudden death decider.
I think perhaps what we should do is agree here that the only winner tonight was Christmas.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And the loser was definitely Waitrose.
And the loser was definitely Waitrose. The only loser was Waitrose. The only winner was Christmas. And Dave Lewis, if you're listening to this, you're on your way back, my friend. You're on your way back.
Absolutely. I was so surprised at the price. So in that, I'm going to ask you individually. Simon, for you, would it change the way you shop, Tesco or Lidl or Waitrose indeed?
Do you know what? I am disadvantaged by the fact that I do have a Lidl near me, but it's a walk away and you can't park there, and I reckon Lidl's the kind of place I'd want to lug a load of shopping back from. but we get our groceries delivered by Tesco. And I'm really into the online shopping experience nowadays, the not having to bother going to the shop.
So you mix it up a bit, but in terms of this one...
I'd go Lidl. It's Lidl. Cheaper. It's equally as good, and it was slightly cheaper.
Lidl. Lee.
Drink Carver at Christmas? Oh, God, it's all about the champagne. What are you talking about?
All right,
but
next
no,
year.
If I was out of this... Definitely go to Lidl, wouldn't you? I mean, you know, there's not much in Lidl and Tesco price-wise, but, you know, if I'm going to save a couple of more quid at Lidl, I'm going to go to Lidl if it's got similar quality stuff.
And for you?
I think if I'm going to buy processed food in future, I'd probably go to Lidl.
That's the spirit. That's the spirit, really. For everything else of this Christmas Day fest?
My local market is just the best.
Okay, so it's Lidl 2, local market.
Yeah, it's nice.
One, but in terms of this taste test, next year we'll bring in the local markets.
It was definitely Lidl. If Lidl could organise their car parking.
All right, Rich Browning. Goodness me. Okay, that was editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce, and development editor Rich Browning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Share Radio has great news. We're going national in March 2016.